From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Rick Burns wanted to make a film that showed the pilgrims in their own terms, not ours. And ours is usually a reverent myth. The real story is darker. It was colder than we imagined and more violent, and the stakes were way higher than most of us realize. The pilgrims themselves, Burns says, were separatists, extremists, really, in their views. They weren't looking for a land of religious liberty. Their vision really only accounted for their own beliefs about God. As one historian puts it in Burns' new film about the pilgrims, they were religious nutters who believed they had been selected by God for a special destiny. Burns' film is on the public television program American Experience, and he'll join us today to talk about the real story of the pilgrims after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Primary Children's Hospital. They're one of 24 children's hospitals in the country that's been recognized by U.S. News and World Reports for providing excellent care in all 10 pediatric specialties. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You probably get that the first Thanksgiving didn't really happen the way your grade school teacher said it did. But even still, you're going to be surprised by the real story told in Rick Burns' new documentary film. The film, called The Pilgrims, it's an epic film, really. It's visceral and beautiful, and you'll be surprised at how few pilgrims there were, just how ill-prepared they were for their voyage, how cold it was and desolate, and how high the stakes. And almost above all, you'll be surprised at how radical their beliefs were, a point made in the film by the historian Pauline Croft.
It's worth reminding ourselves that at the time they were a very, very small group of very extreme people. And if we'd never heard of them ever again, nobody would be surprised. And most English people thought that they were well rid of them. The fact that they are in the long term extraordinarily successful, that they found the world's greatest democracy, throws retrospective luster. They are, one might say, if you wanted to be critical, they're religious nutters who won't settle for anything except the most literal reading of the Bible. They want to transform a nation state into something that resembles what they take to be a godly kingdom.
Today in the program, Rick Burns is joining us to talk about his film. Burns is the director and writer of numerous documentaries, including New York, Death in the Civil War, and Into the Deep, America Wailing in the World. He's joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. And Rick Burns, welcome to you. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
So I guess I want to start by asking you, before we dig into the film itself, how long have you been thinking of the pilgrims? What got you thinking about this subject?
We've been working on the film, not continuously, for about 4 years. It kind of came over the transom as an idea through a college, old college friend in England, a wonderful writer named Nick Bunker, who a few years back wrote a book called Making Haste from Babylon. Yeah. And it's a really incredible account of the pilgrims, both in the old world and in the new. And what's really striking about it when you read the pilgrims' story from the English perspective, written by an Englishman in this case, is you're suddenly made aware the really extraordinary degree to which, even though we think of the pilgrims as being kind of standing for American history, the first moment we like to think of it, although it's not, of course, Jamestown, right, antedated it by 13 years, yeah, we really have a habit of thinking of them as technically English, but really, in fact, instant Americans, because they have qualities, or we think they have qualities, which we like to imagine are at the root of our own character. They're God-fearing. They seem to have come for freedom. That's a more complicated story. In fact, they went through so much trouble to get here. They suffered a lot and endured. And so, therefore, they're the first Americans, and we're very, very pleased to think of them that way. So what happens is we disconnect ourselves from the, in fact, historical, thick, deep, rich, dramatic, sometimes bloody, really harrowing, riveting real history of it. So I think what we wanted to do, following my friend Nick Bunker, whose book was really a kind of a point of departure and not a guide to making the film, was to connect, you know, let's put away 400 years of American exceptionalism and remember these were English people. They were radical. They were very extreme. They had an extraordinary kind of set of pressures on them. And let's really look at that story and try to answer the question, who were they? What drove them on? What made the old world intolerable? How were they transformed as well as transforming along the way? And finally, why the hell do we remember them and think of them the way we do?
Right.
How have they come to sort of cast such a long shadow in the American memory?
It's interesting. You mentioned Nick Bunker, who's in the film, and Pauline Croft. I played that. And then there's Susan Hardman Moore. And there are a number of British historians featured, at least in those early parts of the story. So we get a sense of, and it's important to say, and we'll dig into this as we go, you start the story, or at least the beginnings of it, of course, on the other side of the Atlantic, that perspective from their homeland. And they did, I guess, at least those early pilgrims always consider themselves English. That was important to them. That was part of their identity.
Very much, absolutely. I mean, and something that they clung to ferociously, you know, against the odds as they, you know, left the church, left England, left the old world altogether. They had no sort of particular truck with the idea of America. When they first left, they weren't going to go to America at all, but to go to Holland. So that it was their Englishness was very, very important to them. And what they felt was that the Church of England, which had, of course, converted to Protestantism decades before, first under Henry and then in a more fulsome way under Elizabeth, they felt carried over too many lingering traits of Roman Catholic practice and therefore was corrupt. And in their extreme reading of the Bible and understanding the will of God, this kind of omnipotent creature who had foreordained everything from before the beginning of time, they were going to go to hell if they had anything to do, if they did not separate. And they called themselves that. They called themselves separatists, meaning they had to come out and be separate from the corruption around them, including the corruption in their own Anglican church. Having said that, what they really wanted to do was, in a sense, renovate, not from within, but radically change the way religious practice was working in England. And, of course, that was illegal.
Right.
The Act Against Puritans in 1593 had made it a crime not to attend church, the Church of England, and only the Church of England, to set up and do any kind of sort of practice in private. You could be fined. You could be jailed. You could be banished. And technically, if you came back having violated the terms of your banishment, you could be executed, although that was a relatively remote possibility.
Yeah. But James was – he was new to the throne, so he was going to – there was some sense that he was going to be fairly harsh with those who weren't towing the line, I guess.
You know, there was some hope when he succeeded Elizabeth, who finally died in 1603, because he was Presbyterian from Scotland – that James VI of Scotland, now James I of England, was going to be like maybe better for people who were interested in purifying the church from within, the Puritans,
right?
From which the larger movement from which the separatists came. But it turned out very quickly that James's experience with disunity, with faction, with the lethal possibilities of disharmony in the realm made him even more concerned about implementing and insisting upon a very strict order in religion as in civil life. And of course, in England, in the England of the early 17th century, the church and the state were totally joined.
Right.
The head of the church was the monarch.
Right.
And therefore, the danger to the monarch is if you were threatening to separate religiously from the Church of England, it was on a continuum with the kind of seditious behavior that meant overturning the authority of the king or queen, him or herself.
I don't want to make too much of this, and maybe we can come back to it a little bit later, but I keep keying on certain words in the context and obviously you obviously do this. You think about them in the context of today, but I'm thinking about the words extremist and separatist. And even though the word refugee isn't used, I'm thinking about this story in the context of what's going on today. You must think of the relevance of a story like this for the way we put in perspective what's happening in our own lives today.
No question. I think we do. There is something that is strikingly, incipiently modern.
Yeah.
About the forces at work in the late 16th, early 17th century. And in a very real sense, it's the time, I think, when our own world begins to heave into view in all sorts of ways. I mean, this is a time when England begins to reach out, as were other world empires, to construct more or less permanent networks of commerce and culture around the world, so that in a sense it's the beginning moment of globalization. It's the beginning moment of bringing into contact people of very, very disparate religious, ethnic, national, cultural experience, and therefore the beginning of a kind of a – it's an on-ramp to a whole new catalog of tensions and frictions and indeed of very, very deep conflict, so that – part of the story of the Pilgrims is going to involve not when they first leave England in 1608, but fast forward 10 years to 1618. They've camped out in Holland where they thought they were going to be able to practice yeah. liberal Protestant republic, the most radical Protestant republic in Europe. They were going to be able to get right with God and practice in their own separate ways. When what happens is, first of all, 10 years in Holland is turning their children into Dutch. They're speaking right. a different language, and they're worried they're going to lose this essential Englishness. But even more frightening in the immediate sense is that what we now call the 30 Years' War, this horrific, ultimately 30-year-long struggle between Catholic and Protestant in Europe, which basically burned from one end of Europe to the other eventually, and in northern Holland, in Leiden, 20 miles, 30 miles south of Amsterdam, mm-hmm. they were right in the firing line.
Yeah.
So there are people whose vulnerability was extreme, and their vulnerability to the gale force winds of really virulent religious conflict, in this case between Catholic and Protestant, in which their particularly fundamental view did not actually make them themselves a particularly violent or aggressive group. On the contrary, the separatism that was at their core made them a group that wanted to retreat. They were yeah. kind of withdrawing from the world into their own – they called it a conventicle
right.
because it was their belief that you didn't need a church, you didn't need bishops and popes, you didn't need vestments, mitres, incense, all this stuff which was corrupt practice added onto the church, not found in the Bible. All you needed was what Matthew in Matthew 20 was prescribed. Jesus saying to his followers in Matthew 20, there were two or three gather in my name. There am I in the midst of you.
Yeah.
So that a small handful of people could bring into existence in their collective, intimate, personal belief, the body of Christ. That's what they were looking for. And so in some sense, the vehemence, the vigor and the extremeness of their belief is characteristic of all sorts of fundamentalist tinges in religion. There's a kind of a tenderness and a withdrawing from the world
yeah.
which gives them a little bit of a different character.
And it's a theme in the film because this is – we'll talk about William Bradford here in a moment, but he's constantly dismayed by the idea that they would have to, for example – be on this voyage in the Mayflower with strangers who weren't people who thought the same way they did. When they arrive, having to interact with people who didn't think the way they did. I mean, they really did think, and he really hoped, that they would be able to create a village of like-minded people, and that would be the way they would live.
That's right. I mean, you know, what they wanted to do is separate. And they thought first what they would do is they would separate and meet in William Brewster's front parlor in Scrooby, 3 miles from Austerfield, where yeah. young William Bradford, who at the age of 12 joins the group. You know, he kind of signs on as a young man who's, you know, at sea in the world and looking for an anchor, had lost by the time he was 12 everyone close to him, mother dead, father dead, two sisters gone, two grandfathers gone, his stepfather died. So he was a person who had known death in a traumatizing way and, in fact, fell into what he later described as a long sickness when he was a preteen, clearly some kind of what we now call a kind of a nervous breakdown, which made it impossible for him to work in the fields. And during that crisis, he found his way to William Brewster's house. Brewster was a kind of a Puritan elder, at Cambridge educated, a man of the world, a man who had lived on the continent, and who was now basically one of the many people in this little area of England, 150 miles north of London, the north parts, where Yorkshire, Nottinghamshire, and Lincolnshire share a border. And there in this area, remote enough from the centers of power in England, there existed a strong evangelical Protestant movement trying to find their way in an English world, both temporal and spiritual, which they found increasingly corrupt. Mm-hmm. They thought they were going to find that new Jerusalem. that body of Christ in William Brewster's living room. Right. But they were breaking the law and they had to leave, so they go to Holland. They thought they were going to find it in Holland. And what's very touching to me about the story is that during what they came to think of as the glory years in Leiden, mm-hmm. this kind of wool, cotton cloth manufacturing center, university town in the Netherlands, they found it for a while, gathered by an extraordinarily charismatic preacher, John Robinson, led so ably by William Brewster, with young William Bradford now not 12, now he's 18, then he becomes the age majority, 21. He's very much coming up in the ranks of this group whose numbers are really just a few hundred in line. And they felt, and Bradford is so moving about it, they felt they had found a way to reestablish the church as it had been with Christ and the disciples more authentically, more with more sort of deep felt meaning than any other group in these latter times, as Bradford puts it. And one has a sense that virtually from then on, when they have to leave Leiden in 1618, 1620, one step ahead of the 30 Years' War, that in the sense they have an ache in their heart permanently for this moment when the dream in Leiden, the dream of the body of Christ, had become very palpable and real to them.
Let me play a clip. I want people to hear Roger Rees, the Welsh actor who died of brain cancer this past summer. He plays the role, I guess that's the way to put it, of William Bradford in the film. And I wanted you to say something. Well, let me play this first, because I think it's so interesting the way you use Rees in the film and Bradford's writing. It's almost as if someone had done an interview with him. And of course, he's reading his writing from this book, which is really important here. But here's a moment where Rees, as Bradford, explains how they were feeling that moment you mentioned of leaving Leiden, that sorrow and realizing that they may never see those people in Leiden again as they headed, you know, to that uncertainty of the new world. Here's a moment from Rick Burns' film, The Pilgrims.
And so they left a goodly and pleasant city, which had been their resting place for near 12 years. But they knew they were pilgrims and looked not much on these things, but lift up their eyes to the heavens, their dearest country, and quieted their spirits.
Just as a piece of style, Rick Burns, would you talk about that, how you wanted to use William Bradford and Roger Rees and that performance that he gives? Because it's, I have to say, it's really remarkable.
Well, you know, we knew very early on that we were going to have a character on camera of William Bradford. I mean, Bradford himself is a stunningly intriguing and interesting man. Obviously, through so much in his early life, totally self-taught with the help of William Brewster, unschooled in any other respect, extraordinarily intelligent, extraordinarily sensitive, extraordinarily aware of the world around him, as well as this kind of precocious spiritual inner life.
And beautiful writer.
And a beautiful writer. Yeah. I mean, uniquely amongst the men and women who've started these early colonies, there's really no other text like the book he began to write 10 years after the founding of Plymouth Plantation in 1620. For reasons which are worth discussing. It's really incredible when and why he started to write the book.
Yeah, we'll get to it. It's great.
But there he is with this amazing language, sort of steeped, as Nat Philbrick, the writer, puts it so well, steeped in the Bible, steeped in the literature of his period, and absolutely stunningly powerful. And when you have someone like Roger Rees, and I don't think there really is anybody like Roger Rees, who kind of felt he was completely at home in this early 17th century, sort of late Elizabethan, early Jacobean diction, which perhaps in some other hands might have sounded stilted. But Bradford, in Roger Rees's imagination and heart, kind of unfolded like a sort of an extraordinary limbering of an origami flower. And so you could feel from within the full complexity of a man in full, someone who had deep, deep, faith. At the same time, enormous anxiety, enormous worries, constant questioning. As you know, there's nothing quite more anxious, than a radical Protestant, because you know that God is omnipotent, that He has created everything since before the beginning of time, absolutely predestined it all, and you have no way, you cannot get forgiveness. There's no atonement for your sins. There's no Eucharist. There's no Mass. There's no saying Hail Marys. You're either in the elect or you're not. You're either going to heaven or you're going to hell, and you're going to find out when you die, and what you need to do is, in this state of kind of limbo, which is your life, try to understand and comport yourself with what you understand to be the Word of God, and there's only one way to do that, through Scripture, through the Bible. And he was so immediately drawn into the Bible and so alive to it that he was kind of like a... kind of a human tuning fork, sensitive to spiritual calling within and also to the movements and changes of the group, which was, as far as he was concerned, was the New Jerusalem.
Yeah.
This traveling body of separatists were the people who, in the corpus of their conviction, were forming the Church of God, and that they kept having to move its situation, move its circumstances from one place to another. But I found that it's almost a minor miracle that they had a Bradford with them.
Yeah.
Sort of not only the chief disciple of the group, you know, kind of exhibit A is what a young pilgrim was going to be, but also then the man who in the New World came to be their leader, governor for 31 of the 37 years he was alive in the New World, about half of his life, and essentially their leader the whole time, even when he wasn't technically the governor. And then the chief guardian and caretaker of their memory in this extraordinary text, 270 pages in his own hand.
Well, it seemed to me anyway, one of the central themes of the film, this idea that, and as the historian Bernard Balin puts it, the difference was Bradford, in the sense that he creates this book that, and people talk about this in the film, that shapes this story. Because Bradford understands, as you put it in the film, that he, by writing this story, crafts its future in its history. And he's the one that's creating that history. And that's an important theme in the film, I'm guessing.
A very, very important theme. I mean, we'll get to why it was that Bradford came, in a way that's deeply, deeply moving, came to feel that the religious experiment had gone astray and that they were not going to succeed.
Right.
But the book was going to be there in his way, and he began to write the book when he could see the handwriting on the wall and understand that even if they succeeded in a material sense, the spiritual mission looked like it was going to begin to disintegrate, as indeed it did. And it was at that moment that he sat down to write this book, because as the incredible scholar, there's so many fantastic scholars who we had access to for this film, Kathleen Donegan, said he came to understand that the pilgrims, who were going to have no future as a material conventicle, that their future was going to be in their history,
right.
that history itself was going to be the way they were going to have some kind of posterity. And so Bradford was going to commit himself, and did commit himself, to record in this extraordinary text, written in the third person as if to a long posterity. Mm-hmm. So he even refers to himself as William Bradford. And for all that, however, there's not any lack of kind of personality and intimacy in the book. He's going to shape that history and do everything he can as the experiment begins to falter and fail, to hand down, once he's gone, some account of who they were, what they were trying to do, and why perhaps, even though they had failed, they mattered.
Rick Burns is with us. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the filmmaker Rick Burns to talk about the real story of the Pilgrims. Burns has created a new documentary for the public television program American Experience. Burns explains how it is that this tiny, really, group of very extreme religious believers happened to found one of the world's great democracies. He's joining us from the studios of NPR in New York. I want to play a clip from Kathleen Donegan, who, mentioned earlier, is really terrific in the film, and the perspective that she gives is interesting. Here's where she's talking about the need to kind of rethink the myth that this became the story of national origin, even though it was maybe different than the myth conveys. Let me play this because I want to ask you something about it. This is Kathleen Donegan from Rick Burns' film, The Pilgrims.
Because the Pilgrims have been so enshrined in the national imagination, because they've meant so much in what we've told ourselves about who we are as Americans, we need to go back and ask questions about why we picked that story, what it was about these people, what it was about their history that we wanted to see reflected in our own national image. There's been a tremendous amount of memory produced around the Pilgrims, but there's also been a lot of forgetting. You know, that memory is very selective. And so to look at what's been remembered and let that shed light on what's been forgotten is an important exercise when we're thinking about something that has been so central to our national imagination.
What does she mean that we want to see this story reflected in our national image, our national imagination? What is she getting at there?
She's getting at the fact that the story of the Pilgrims, they were not a representative group.
Yeah.
They were not the first group, though they called themselves the first comers. Jamestown had been founded, as we mentioned before, 1607, 13 years before they got there, much greater numbers. And in many ways has a greater claim as being sort of from a kind of an imperial, from the point of view of empire, as being the beginning of the English colonial experience in America. We don't celebrate Jamestown at the end. Every Thanksgiving we celebrate this small, tiny group that almost wiped out, you know, in their first few years in the New World. And so I think what she's doing is something which I find really fascinating and even moving as a historian. She's saying that when we find ourselves confronting with something which we think of as so central to who we are, and yet there are reasons to sort of wonder, is there more to this story? They weren't the first. Did they come for freedom? They were so sort of unrepresentative of the people they came from. That we need to do two things. First of all, we need to sort of not reject their story, not reject the story that's been handed down, but rather kind of move the candle of history, of historiography, a little bit to the left and a little bit to the right. Look, she says somewhere in a part of her interview, which we didn't use, she said, the things that we remember and the things that we forget are very often very close to each other. And so what she wants to do and what she advises us to do, urges us to do, is move the candle over to those things that are kind of in the shadows or maybe completely in the darkness, that are part of the historical record but don't come within the glow of the story we're telling. Also, slow down. Don't go quickly. Don't take the Pilgrim narrative in the kind of the trippingly rapid way we do. Well, they came over. They were looking for freedom and believed in God. They had a terrible time. But thanks to the providence of God, they got through it and survived. Well, she says, listen, when more than half of your number, more than 50, die in 3 months, such that five whole families are wiped out, every family loses a husband or wife, their orphaned children, dead children, men, single men who came alone and died alone, the impact of that trauma changed them, scarred them, marked the Pilgrims permanently. And what you want to do is, you know, sort of in a more kind of contemporary psychological term, you want to sit with the feeling. Don't jump to conclusions. Don't try to make it fit into a narrative. So that's, she wants to not so much dismiss the Pilgrim narrative that's been handed down, but look at what it has been left out of it, and then look at that whole thing and see if she can't answer the question, what was posterity, we Americans, after there was an America? And we have to remember they didn't come to found America.
Right.
They came to get right with God and be the best English people they could be. Looking back, once there was an America by name, there were people who came in much later, 200, 250 years later, to look back and say, even though it doesn't fit the calendar quite right, even though the circumstances are not all of them compatible with what we want to think of ourselves, we're going to look at this story and see in the story of these people as Bradford and others have told it, but mainly Bradford, who we are as Americans, who do we want to be as Americans, And by the mid-19th century, that had become something. In the early 17th century, that had no meaning whatsoever to anybody.
Right.
But by the mid-19th century, a huge argument was taking place in America. What does it mean to be an American? Where are the roots of the America we think we are? And we, of course, came to fight a tremendously bloody civil war about exactly that question, which was essentially a war fought out to say, to ask and answer the question, did America begin in slaveholding Jamestown?
Mm-hmm.
Or did it begin in Puritan England, New England, in Plymouth Colony? And we came to feel, because the North won that war, that that's where our real roots were, with a group who could recognizably embodied a kind of a mid-19th century ideal. People who came to this country looking for freedom, we thought, who didn't own slaves, who came in families, who seem to have been, and there's aspects of the record that support this, even though there are also aspects of the record that don't, who made friends with the local people, were accommodating, broke bread, shared their God with them. So that's an American, an American root we can believe in and cherish and hold closely in the mid-19th century when the country is ripping itself apart precisely over this question of where are we going and where have we come from as Americans. Her version of American history, and indeed we followed her more than any of our other extraordinary historians in seeking to craft a narrative out of this, is not only a story of something that happened, you know, roughly in the first few decades of the 17th century. It's also a story about memory. It's a story about the story, how that story came to be shaped, came to be in some ways distorted, and even how it came to be handed down in history such that the final chapter, in a very meaningful way, not just in a kind of intellectual conceit, the final chapters of the Pilgrim story took place long, 200, 250 years later in the 19th century.
I wanted to mention there's this paradox that plays out in the story too. One that may help explain, I think, how this tiny group of believers helped found this democracy. There's this custom, for example, of the separation of church and state was interesting.
Right.
Because William Bradford, he's married in Leiden, not in a church, but in a government building. They didn't believe in that. So there was one custom there. But then on the other hand, they didn't in fact believe necessarily in religious liberty. But then they create this Mayflower Compact, which limits the authority of the monarch, gives the power to people to consent. So there's this kind of give and take going on about liberty, about authority, about separating church and state, and yet not. It's such an interesting paradox.
Oh, it is such an interesting paradox. You know, Doug, and you're putting your finger so acutely on this crucial aspect of the story. They didn't come for freedom. They came to be free to worship as they wished. They actually did not believe, as Kathleen Donegan puts it, they didn't believe in diversity of practice. They believed in expelling contaminants. They believed in keeping the body of Christ as pure and homogeneous as possible. But to do that, they had to challenge the authority of other churches, the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church. And in fact, at the heart of radical Protestantism, at the heart of the Protestant Reformation, is a challenge to the temporal authority, any temporal authority claiming to have any kind of spiritual authority. So if there's no pope, no bishop, no priest who has some special merit or authority and can tell you what to do, what's left? Where does the authority lie? It lies in a relationship between each individual human soul and his or her God. What that means is that there's a radical spiritual egalitarianism at the core of the Protestant Reformation. And that is what no one intended it to become the root of democracy, but almost inescapably, that was the genie that got out of the bottle. And when they came over here, one of the things that happened was there was a constant splintering of groups like the Pilgrims. Because if there's no single authority, Pope on down, to tell you, you know, here's the law and here's how it's going to work, then there's nothing to stop new groups from constantly bubbling to the surface and saying, I'm so sorry. My conviction is that this is the one and only right way. My conviction is that this is what Scripture comes, because it's in this dynamic that's taking place between you, your soul, and God. So there was a kind of unintended consequence which had profound kind of a vector of egalitarianism, proto-democracy, and indeed the compact itself shows you that. They arrive off the coast of Massachusetts, 200 miles north of where they were supposed to be. They were supposed to have gone to New York,
right?
Which is an extraordinary thing to consider, the Pilgrims having landed on Manhattan as opposed to on the coast of Massachusetts. They had a patent from the Virginia Company and a charter from King James allowing them to settle in the northern area of the Virginia colony, which was around the lower Hudson River. Having landed there, now half of the people on the Mayflower are not part of the radical group. They're strangers to the Pilgrims, and the Pilgrims called them strangers. Right. They're people who the investors insisted go with the Pilgrims because they wanted to have some practical people who weren't simply going to sort of get, sort of sidetracked by God, but actually be more interested in making money, which is what the investors were looking for. Now, those strangers, as soon as they're in the wrong place with no legal charter, and in this respect, the Pilgrims are really the first illegal aliens, they get to the coast of Massachusetts, and before they even get off the ship, the strangers say, we're going to rebel. We're going to leave. As soon as we're hit dry land, we're going to go our own way. That would have been a catastrophic fragmentation of this tiny group, 100-plus people. The compact is a single sentence, one sentence, that says nothing more or less than this. We, the underside, agree that we, the underside, will have all the authority to make the laws that are necessary to make this group into a solemn binding combination that will make this group cohere. Yeah. So all they're saying is that the authority going forward henceforth will come from the will of the people. That the need for that comes exactly from the fact that there is no elder, there's no minister, there's no priest, there's no king or queen who can tell them what to do because they've already rejected that. So if they're trying to keep unity, they have to sit down and go, where will that unity come from? And there's really only one other source. You could do it at gunpoint, which won't work. And in fact, they only had, one soldier with them, Miles Standish. So short of that, you're going to have to do it by consensus, by creating a contract, which is going to be this solemn binding combination. That document, which you can make too much of. It is not, as the historian John Demos puts it, it's not an elaborate plan for democracy.
It's a contract.
A democratic government. But it's a contract, which carries a kind of like, it's like the stem cell of democracy. In it, you can see the absolute necessary precondition under which democracy will come about. And indeed, a few decades later, when William Bradford, John Winthrop, and others from the Boston colony, which came later, were codifying what they called a new book of laws. They alluded explicitly to the Mayflower Compact, which had been created in November of 1620 off the shore of Massachusetts. And they said that although it stipulated it was in fact addressed to the monarch, it said in so many words in the new book of laws that the Mayflower Compact made clear that there were certain occasions of political crisis when the will of the monarch could be abridged, but the will of the people could never be abridged. So in this, I find, one of the wonderful things, one of the many wonderful and strange and often harrowing and dark things about the Pilgrim story is these little tiny moments in which, in hindsight, we can see aborning absolutely critical aspects of what will become, sometimes not for hundreds of years, key parts of the American experience.
Rick Burns is with us. His film is The Pilgrims. We'll take another quick break and be back with Rick Burns in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with filmmaker Rick Burns. We're talking about his extraordinary documentary, The Pilgrims, which is on the PBS series American Experience. Rick Burns is joining us from the studios of NPR in New York City. Well, as your film conveys, when the Pilgrim, and it's a terrific story about just them getting here, but when they arrive, what they see is amazing, and it's desolation, basically, beautifully expressed by William Bradford. Here's again the actor Roger Rees talking about what they see when they arrive.
Being thus past the vast ocean and a sea of troubles, they now had no friends to welcome them, or inns to repair to, or to refresh their weather-beaten bodies. No houses, much less towns to repair to seek for succor. And for the season, it was winter. And they that know the winters of that country know them to be sharp and harsh, subject to cruel and fierce storms. Besides, what could they see but a hideous, desolate wilderness full of wild beasts and wild men?
And wild men, which gets us into a really critical part of the story, and that is, of course, the story of the natives they encountered. I want to ask you about this. This is one of the things that I think will surprise people. Of course, people understand that there were natives there, of course. But Linda Coombs, who's terrific, an historian, Wampanoag historian, talks about there were 69 villages. And she says, figure it out, if there were about between 100 and 2,000 people in these different villages. And so she said there's something like 70,000 people there. In that would have been in that region. But of course, they're desolated by this plague. Would you just give us that perspective, Rick Burns? It's an important part of the story, of course.
It's incredibly densely populated, culturally rich, politically complex set of societies that are on all across North America and had been there for hundreds, thousands. I mean, archaeologists still debate exactly when they first began. It's a question that's up for grabs. And in this immediate area, one of the great sort of aspects of historical happenstance that totally conditioned the pilgrims' experience in the New World was the fact that in the 3 years before they'd come, from 1616 to 1619, one of the most virulent plagues or epidemics that ever hit North America, one of the virgin soil epidemics, you know, sort of diseases brought over by a fisherman in this case, had sort of swept down the coastline from Maine down to what we now call Rhode Island. Yeah. And absolutely wrought havoc with Native American populations. I mean, 40%, 50%, 70%, 80%, 90% in some places. Rapid, sudden death up to 20, maybe even 30 miles inland during this period. And the worst hit, the ground zero of this particular epidemic, was a place called Patuxet, which was one of the main thriving villages, probably 2,000 people in it. Patuxet is what we now call Plymouth.
Right.
Everyone, 100% mortality. So they arrive off the coast, begin to have a sense of exactly what they're up to, having to build everything from scratch on the edge of a New England winter in the middle of the Little Ice Age. It was much colder and more savage than it is now. And the place that they choose, having landed in the wrong place, is Patuxet, because it's already been cleared. And they spend weeks looking for what they think will be a convenient and appropriate spot, settle on this spot. But it's essentially a place in which the devastation was so great that there are unburied bodies. There are skeletons they discover the next summer kind of bleaching, you know, in the fields and in the woods, because there was no one to bury the dead, not because Native Americans didn't have profound and in many ways more profound and more complex burial rituals than European peoples did. So they come to this place of mass death, and then themselves begin to fall apart in that first year. So this sort of theme of, not theme, this kind of basic iron reality, which is that they're confronted by existential circumstances and the specter of death, both in terms of the population who have been there and their own population. If they had gone someplace else where their native population was less disabled, and there were plenty of other places to go, they would have had a much different kind of time. Yeah. They probably wouldn't have formed an alliance.
I want to play another moment, because one of the points the film makes is that, yes, it's true this area had been decimated by plague, but and that gave them a sense that this was somehow God's will, of course, but the place wasn't empty, of course. And Margaret Bruchock, this anthropologist who's great in the film, makes this point. Tobias Vanderhoop, who's chairman of the Wampanoag branch, talks about this. Let me play this, because I think this is an important, another important theme in the film.
It's very convenient for the telling of American history to start with the plague, to start with this massive death. But when those plagues happen, they are not as total as they appear. There are some areas that were virtually untouched by the plague. It was not so empty that it was ready to be reoccupied by someone from across the ocean.
But when they arrived in this territory, they believed that their journey was ordained by God, that they had a mission that they were to fulfill, and the desolation that they found was God's providence. It was meant to be that way for them.
They did not view native people as humans. They saw them almost as beasts and vermin who were cleared away by God's pestilence to make room for God's chosen people. And so I think it's necessary to ask who the savages were. Were they the people who had lived in this territory for millennia, or were they these people who forced themselves into someone else's home?
This is such an important theme, too, because you talk about how they, even their first forays into this land had this primal, here's how you put it, transgressive character to them. Would you talk about that?
You know, and it is. It's one of the eeriest things that are, you know, in these shore expeditions. They arrive off the coast in mid-November, and it's not until really mid-December that they settle on Plymouth, which is on the far side of the bay. They're up, you know, basically anchored off what's now Provincetown on the tip of Cape Cod, and they work their way down the Cape looking for water, looking for a place to settle. And the native peoples that they do encounter, or rather that they don't quite encounter, it's quite extraordinary. They're kind of keeping their distance from the pilgrims, not quite sure what to make of them. And they come across abandoned villages or villages that no one's in. They come across mounds which, on opening them up, turn out to be corn caches, which they raid and steal against the coming winter. They come across graves, which also, quite amazingly, they open up. And with a kind of like almost, it's almost like something out of The Shining, a kind of like spellbound, dreamlike, kind of transgressive, invasive demeanor, begin to open up mats, bundles with sort of bodies in them, and speculate, why does this larger skeleton have blonde hair still attached to its head? That means he's European. Who put him here? Here's a small Indian child with beads and dark hair. So you have the sense of people kind of wandering almost as in a dream into some of the most intimate and complex and harrowing aspects of human reality, which is really, in a sense, exactly what's going to happen to them. They're wandering into a place of mass death, are going to themselves be overtaken by death, and it's in that confrontation, about as primal a confrontation as you can have existentially and not simply be entirely wiped out, through with suffering and with death, they begin to be really changed in ways that are inevitable, and also that in are ways that really show you a kind of a primal distinction which they begin to make between what it means to be a dead English person and what it means to be a dead Native American. The latter, the dead, the bones of the bleaching bones of the dead Native Americans are to them sort of scattered carcasses in the wilderness. It's something out of Isaiah. This image of the curse of God sort of visited the doubters and the people whose faith had faltered on the way out of Egypt. So that's all. The Indian death is all about dispossession, about not having a claim to the land. Their death, however, is about becoming a seed. It's about taking that suffering, burying it into the ground, and laying claim through that to the ground. And as Kathleen Donegan puts it in really one of her most brilliant moments, it seemed to me, that it may well have been the most important thing the pilgrims of Plymouth Plantation planted was their own dead.
Yeah. I wanted to finally talk about the Thanksgiving story, which you write about in, or talk about in the film. Linda Coombs is amazing here as well, and talks about how, you know, basically we have four little facts to go on. The rest, as she says, is fluff. There's not really much of a record. But again, going back to Kathleen Donegan again, she explains why it is we love this story, and obviously thinking about Thursday coming up. A lot of us think about this as abundance, Donegan says, but really this was more about this feast or whatever it was more about mourning, more about grief. And I think it's important to say something about that as we head into the Thanksgiving season.
And there's no question. I mean, there's a people who as Donegan puts it, these are an aggrieved, grieving, mourning people who are so traumatized, who have no idea what the future is holding for them, are desperately looking for signs from God that they're not going to slip into an absolute kind of shattered corpse, world of corpses. And when, thanks to the alliance that they're able to fashion with the Wampanoags, which they're able to fashion precisely because the Wampanoags are themselves so decimated, they're looking for an ally. So really imagine the Pilgrims and the Wampanoags, whose territory they end up in, as sort of two spent swimmers in very, very high seas, needing to clutch onto each other for survival. And indeed, that is part of the key to their survival. Tisquantum, a Native American whose name we think of him as Squanto, is left to – he's the only survivor of Patuxet from the plague. He is deputized. He speaks English. He had been enslaved in Europe, come back to find his village absolutely gone. And he is then deputized to be the interpreter and cultural advisor to the Pilgrims. It's his – the help that they have from Squanto tending to their crops that leads to this first successful harvest, which is absolutely key to their survival. So they sit down, and when Edward Winslow, in one sentence in his account of what happened, talks about their decision to rejoice together because the crop had come in plentifully enough to help them out. That's it. Nobody talks about it as Thanksgiving. Nobody talks about it. William Bradford doesn't say a word about it. And it's very, very clear that present in their minds are the half of their number who are gone. So that it's a moment of deep, deep sort of inner savoring the fact that some are gone, some remain, maybe there is some way forward. That's the Thanksgiving that really took place to the degree that it ever really did take place.
Filmmaker and writer Rick Burns, he joined us from the NPR studios in New York City. Rick Burns, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Doug. It was wonderful to speak with you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
Why aren't you on Twitter?
Because I'm terrible at Twitter. Sometimes our reporters can sound just a little stiff on air.
Do you not think it's real life?
No, I don't think I do.
Oh.
But like you just heard, Julia Ritchie, she's kind of funny. This is Doug Fabrizio, by the way. You can hear our conversation about Twitter and politics on our new podcast. It's called More to Say. You can download it wherever you get your podcasts.